Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel, Kim and Chris. On today's Australian Open Round 4 catch-up,
Taylor Fritz exacts revenge on Stefanos Tsitsipas.
Qin Wenzheng makes the quarters.
And Novak Djokovic back at his best against Manarino.
Chris, today is the 22nd of January and we are here to catch up on round 4 of the Australian Open at Tennis Weekly HQ. What a round 4 we have had. We are now looking on to the quarterfinals and I've got to say, the ladies singles draw, that top half, it is as open as I think I have ever seen.
Well, you might be looking forward. I'm looking back and thinking, Iga, we really could have done with you in the semi-final lineup, and so could the organisers. They could do with a big name for that semi-final. But hopefully there will be a great story no matter what. You know, Yastremska qualifier making it this far. And
is she going to do a Raducanu? Is that what we can call it now? Is it doing a Raducanu if you go on a run as a qualifier and maybe make a Grand Slam final?
Well, I mean, it would be unheard of. I mean, it had never happened before, and then it might happen again. But I do believe that she has lost a set. So doing a Raducanu is winning of your matches in straight sets, all 10 of them. So it's emulating her. But I mean, the GOAT of the qualifier winning a slam has to be Raducanu herself.
Well, we're going to be talking about all of that action today. We're also going to be looking back on day 8 as well. And we are going to be revealing our collector set winner. Collector set has been, Chris, it's been crazy. It's broken all records, this Australian Open collector set.
I've not broken any records in terms of the number of predictions
actually,
I've got,
yeah,
right?
You've not broken any records.
You might have.
Actually, I'm gonna leave it there. But yes, we're going to be revealing our collector set winner later on. But before we get into the episode, little celebration for Tennis Weekly podcast. It is our 400th episode.
Wow, I feel like we only had 300 quite recently, if I'm honest.
I know.
I mean, that was probably end of 2022 was 300. Yes. So, I mean, what a feat, Joel. I think, does it feel like 400?
Do you know what? I almost forget about the number that we're on, unless it's like I'm editing late at night and I have to put the little episode number into our kind of publisher platform. But it's an incredible feat. I mean, 400 episodes. I know Kim loves Sachi. She's been listening back to episodes like episode 1, episode 2, and I do like to think we've come on just a little bit since then.
Oh, she's loving it. And I think she was actually a little bit annoyed in the scheduling that I took this slot and took the glory of 400 having joined 400. Most recently. Exactly.
Yes, I know.
And we can just say, well done, Joel, you know, 400 in and here's to another 400 more.
I know. Oh, great. I can't wait. Pat on the back for Tennis Weekly podcast, 400 episodes. Yeah, absolutely love it. But let's actually move on to the action. And we're going to start, Chris, with day 9, all the women's action that we had, because yes, we thought Svitolina, Azarenka, this was theirs for the taking. And did it prove to be that case? Absolutely not. We've got qualifier Diana Yastremska ousting Victoria Azarenka in straight sets, 7-6, 6-4. This was a very tough tussle for Yastremska, who saved 2 set points in that first set, had to come back from a breakdown in that second set. How impressed have you been with Diana Yastremska? Because I feel like I've only really spoken to her about the, you know, that ordeal she went through when she tested positive and, you know, she was off the tour for 6 months. But to come back, the tennis she is playing into a Grand Slam singles quarterfinal for the first time, that's very impressive.
Yeah, and it just shows that you're able to do anything from anywhere in the women's game. I think we'll see this when we look at some of the other semi-finalists. They aren't necessarily the form players. And with Yastremska, I mean, she's someone who has been, I think, as high as 21 in the world or very close to top 20. So she does have the pedigree, and she did a lot of that when she was in her teenage years, winning three titles before she turned 20. She really was a prodigy in many ways, and many people thought that she would go a lot further, but she's got really big hitting and free hitting off both sides. And I always remember watching some of her matches and just thinking, she's fearless. And I think maybe kind of in the last few years, her focus wasn't as much on tennis. I think she maybe had a lot of other things going on, maybe her Instagram account, but also the conflict with Russia and the war. So I think that that's something which I think now is inspiring her in the way that she's playing and kind of performing a bit like a warrior on court in terms of how she's going after those big moments. And she's doing it for her country. So I think it's impressive. But I mean, Azarenka, Joel, we have to talk about it. She should have won that first set, and she probably should have won the second one as well. Up a break in both, set points. What went wrong?
Yeah, it's surprising. You think the experience of someone like Azarenka, who's had, she's had good form in the past at the Australian Open, would have been able to use that to get over the line in the first set. But yeah, she will be very, I think, disappointed. And as you said, I think the power that Yastremska has, I do think she's one of the purest hitters, from the baseline on the tennis court. She hit 38 winners compared to Azarenka's 16. She came to the net as well, and actually she's very handy at the net. She won 12 out of 13 when she was at the net. So I think, with Yastremska, she just sort of took it away from Azarenka, who wasn't able to just assert her game. And when she wasn't able to assert her game, I say that was when I think Yastremska was on top and able to pull out the victory. And, as a qualifier, I think having those matches, being there, the week before helps. But yeah, it's a big opportunity now for someone to, someone who's not experienced at this level to go and seize their moment.
Yeah, and you kind of talked about the experience of Azarenka, and a lot of the players have talked about it. As you do get a bit more mature on the tour, these opportunities don't come around as frequently, and sometimes it can make it harder in those moments to play with a loose arm. And I think on serve, she said it in her press conference afterwards, she wasn't happy with how her first serve performed. It was quite a low first serve percentage for her, and she only won 52% of first serve points behind it. So that does kind of scream a little bit of tension in the arm. And she was misfiring on the forehand. So I think it does present itself that, it's out with the old order. And I think every quarterfinalist is from Gen Z, Joel, which is the first time that we've had that for the women's game. We've never had that for the men's, obviously. We can't have, because Djokovic is still around and Nadal as well. So it's new ground.
It feels like it's just full of teenagers, particularly in this top half.
And then Krejcikova.
and Krejcikova. And I mean, just looking at the other, the other matches that went on, I mean, we've got to speak about Linda Noskova versus Elena Svitolina. This was very sad, very tough to watch, because Svitolina had to retire 3-love down against Noskova, felt a spasm in her back and didn't feel like she was able to continue. Chris, she was your pick to win.
She was.
The singles trophy. This is going to be a very bitter pill to swallow.
It was a really good opportunity for her. She was playing fantastic tennis, like top 5 tennis, I think, in Auckland. And she hadn't dropped a set coming into this match. So you really think that the tears that she had were the tears of the pain of having to retire, but also the fact that this was the perfect opportunity for her. And it was opening itself up for her to really do something special. She had a great draw, obviously, at Wimbledon. She took out the number one seed in Iga Świątek. So you really have to think it's going to be, yeah, as you said, it's going to be tough. But at the end of the day, will she be back? Absolutely. And having kind of spent a year coming back onto the tour, I think it's definitely clear that she is very much a contender in Grand Slams and in tour level matches.
I mean, she had just lost only 13 games across her 3 matches to reach round 4. And it just, I think, showed just the form and the level that Svitolina was playing at. I mean, just talking about Noskova, she defeated world number one Iga Świątek. She is in the quarterfinals. She is a player, on the up. A lot of people talking about her. Is she, like, I know we've got Qin Wenzheng, which we're going to get on into in a sec, but because you're the player who has defeated the world number one, do you feel like she is the front runner in this really open top half, or do you still go with the seeds and the rankings?
I think you'd have to say someone who's been to this stage before. Quinn Wenzhen reached the quarterfinals of the US Open. It's her second consecutive quarterfinal. She's been in fourth rounds before. And the fact that she did kind of dispatch Doden in her fourth round match, I really do think shows that she wasn't necessarily perturbed by the fact that this draw was opening up for her. And sometimes you see, you know, when it's yours to lose, in many ways, players do get kind of a bit in their heads about it. They do look ahead at the draw, but she seems to be like a very grounded individual who I don't think that she'll let that kind of get in the way, and she seems to be taking it well. But for me, Yastremska is going to be a real tricky customer to uproot, because she's down and out in points, in sets, in games, and she keeps coming back. So I think that a player that doesn't know when they're beaten, who has a lot of confidence, more confidence than they've ever had, who really believes they're going to do something, I think that belief is something she can trade off. And probably, having had those more competitive matches, I think Noskova needed to prove that she was going to back up that win, and she hasn't had that opportunity yet.
Well, looking at the other part of the top half, we've got Qingwen Zheng versus Kalinskaya in the other quarterfinal. I mean, let's talk, Chris, about Kalinskaya, because she's not like the others. She's not really an up-and-coming, you know, teenager. You know, she's 25 years old. You know, she's in or around the 100 ranking mark on the tour. You know, she defeated Paolini 6-4, 6-2. Again, I'm just surprised we're talking about a player like Kalinskaya, who is now in a quarterfinal for the first time in a Grand Slam. This one is probably the most surprising to me.
I don't think many people would have picked it. She has actually been on my sort of radar a little bit, because she did take out Harriet Dart at the Japan Open last year. And I thought that wasn't necessarily a great performance from Dart. And then Dart went on to, you know, she's now made the biggest final of her career at a 100 tournament. So Dart was not playing badly. She also took out Heather Watson. So I saw her name a couple of times at the end of last year. And that was on the way to actually winning a 125 in Midland in the US. So she had some form at the end of last season. And then going into this season, she's had some good matches. I mean, do I think that she had kind of quarterfinal potential? I didn't think that, but she pushed Kasatkina all the way in Adelaide. She took out Krejcikova in Adelaide as well. So she's playing some good tennis. And I mean, I think she's having to kind of get it done. I think against Stevens, she's grinding that one out. But apart from that, she's been pretty secure in the way that she's been playing. So I think in uncharted territory, there's nothing to lose. And I think a lot of these players, you know, her career high is somewhere around 51, I think, in the world, currently at 75. I mean, it doesn't really matter what your ranking is now. It's about who can get the win.
Yeah. And I mean, amongst these players who are in, you know, new territory for the first time, it might well come down to who handles these new experiences the best. But I mean, Qingwen Zheng, who is here, as you said, she has been in a singles quarterfinal before. She did that at the US Open last year. I mean, she defeated Dodin of France 6-love, 6-3. Pretty ruthless. Job done in an hour. I just spoke about Noska, but, you know, defeating Świątek, and is she the favourite? Do you feel like Zheng is like here and she's like, hang on, if I don't make the Grand Slam final here, this Grand Slam is a failure to me now?
I think there will definitely be a question mark if she doesn't go further in the draw. I think a lot of people are now getting very excited for the prospect of like a Sabalenka Zheng final, or, you know, a Coco Gauff or Sabalenka in that final. So I think that's what people are looking forward to. I think they do that from the perspective of, you know, everyone wants to see the highest ranked players in the final, unless it's kind of a home favorite. So I think that there's a lot of people who'd like to see that. I don't think it would necessarily be like a failure on her part, because, you know, these players have all got to this stage, and that's something that, when pushed on it, Svitolina said that once you reach the stage of a Grand Slam, you're beating good players. And all of these players have been beating good players to get here. So there's no easy matches, especially in a quarterfinal of a Grand Slam. But I think her coaching setup is much more solid now. She's got Per Ruber back on side, who kind of parted ways with Coco Gauff. And I think that's working really well. I think she's actually added to her game from what was a successful end of last season. So on the form book, on the ranking, on the experience, you'd have to say that she'd be your pick.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how she goes. I mean, I feel like there's that whole narrative around Lina, and she must be thinking,
and they met and everything.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, oh, if I get to a Grand Slam final, that is going to be money. That is going to be big money opening up, big audiences opening up. You know, there's been a lot of pressure on her, and maybe the Australian Open this year, it's her time. She's certainly, I think, the favourite. I mean, just before we move on to the men, talking about the fact that, you know, this draw to the casual fans, a lot of these players, they won't know. Will that mean that there'll be less interest, do you think, in the ladies' competition? Because, you know, before we were recording, we talked about the fact that, you know, I personally think there'll be people out there who think, well, the men's draw is shaping up very, very well. Top six seeds still in. And we've got this happening in the ladies' draw. Arguably, the men's draw is more exciting than the women's draw, which we haven't really said a lot, I think, for the last few Grand Slams.
Yeah, Joel, you've been sold on WTA tennis for a while now. So
no,
this is.
I'm going to flip flop back now to the.
Okay, because this is stretching even your kind of knowledge of WTA with some of the names who've made it to the.
Yes.
The quarterfinals.
I mean, Kalinskaya is like a WTA 125 player at the moment, not a regular 250, 500 Masters Tour player.
Yes, she's not had much experience at that level, that's for sure. What do I think? I think. Personally, I like seeing a more inexperienced player play against a seed or someone who's been in the situation before, and then that creates quite a fun narrative. You know, I think we saw that in the Noskova Świątek match when it's upset alert. People love that, but I think it's now very hard for people to know who to root for. The story is a bit confusing. You know, I think there's obviously a player who's not able to play for their nation as part of that, so then that might not be the story of the person that you root for. You've got the whole Yastremska playing for Ukraine. So there are some stories in there as well. But it is a bit unusual when you're like, I'm not sure who should be playing, and I'm not sure what would necessarily bring about the best matches, because I think these players play particularly well against players they shouldn't be beating, or on paper they shouldn't be beating. And when they play against each other, I think we've seen a few in the past where it might not be the highest level. So fingers crossed that I'm proven wrong and we do get some great matches. But I think some people will be doing some Googling before they hit the quarterfinals of the Australian Open, for sure.
Certainly. And moving on to the men's matches that we had on day nine, let's first of all talk about Carlos Alcaraz and Sasha Zverev, because they're going to be facing each other in their quarterfinal. Intriguingly, Zverev has a leading head-to-head against Alcaraz, 4-3.
Alcaraz defeated... yeah.
Yeah, and Alcaraz defeated Kecmanovic in straight sets, 6-4, 6-4, 6-love. Zverev defeated Nori in five sets, which we're going to talk about in a sec. But, I mean, with Alcaraz, is he playing his way into the tournament, do you think?
I think he is. I think he's playing better and better with each match, and I can't really believe this is his first Australian Open quarterfinal. He seems really at home on the courts, and he hadn't really had that much experience here before. I think he went out to... maybe it was Berrettini or something in 2022 and didn't play last year. So, he's taken to it really well. And I think the fact that he is able to kind of play himself into the tournament, get these matches under his belt without necessarily having to play too much time on court will help him when it gets physical later on in the tournament. So, I mean, he's upped his game. I think this one is also a case that Kecmanovic has obviously played so many long matches.
Tired, didn't he?
Yeah, how can you not be, especially after... having had, I mean, two five-setters and one four-setter, all of them
14
going...
out of 15 sets of tennis played. It's a lot.
It is a lot. And I think it was kind of, Kim said it's almost a foregone conclusion, a bit like the Manorino match for Djokovic that we will talk about, where it's not a contest because their contest is over because they've played so much beforehand. So it's hard to know because, I mean, a fully fit Kecmanovic, I think, could do some damage, and I think he has the game to. But this never really kind of got going from an excitement perspective, which is very different, obviously, to Zverev, who that was a final set tiebreak. So will it be the case again, Joel, that someone playing the long matches to get to the later stages will actually impact their chances in the quarterfinals?
I know, because Zverev, I mean, not just this match, he has also played a lot of tennis, a lot more tennis, you know, on the courts of the Australian Open than Carlos Alcaraz to get to the quarterfinals. He came through against Cam Norrie, 7-5, 3-6, 6-3, 4-6, 7-6, won that final set tiebreak, 10-3. And, I mean, he's into the quarterfinals. Cam Norrie, Britain's Cam Norrie's run has ended. Before we talk about Zverev, I mean, what did you make of Norrie's performance? The fact that he beat Casper Ruud, played very, very well there, probably one of his best ever Grand Slam performances. I actually personally think he upped it against Zverev, a player who he's had no success against in the past. He's not even won a set against him in the past. To push him the way he did, that was a pretty good effort, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I like the misses he made. I was watching it. I think, Joel, we talked about this before we started recording. We were both up in the early hours watching some of that. Yeah. And I just like the fact he's going for it, because I think he had a year last year where maybe he has some regrets about the fact that he didn't try to go for more and play more aggressively, because he's definitely made a concerted effort to be more aggressive. And there are good misses and bad misses. And I think he made a lot of good misses at key moments. And previously, I think sometimes he has sort of been pushing the ball at times, that forehand sitting up at, and that backhand obviously is very flat, but he's able to almost redirect it, steer it into the court rather than always hit it. And to be honest, I just really like the fact that he was playing a bit of a different game, and it was actually causing quite a lot of problems for Zverev, and it could have gone either way. And I think you'd argue that he's back at playing sort of top 10 tennis, really. So it's going to be interesting, because he's got points to defend, obviously, in the Golden Swing. I think he did pick up a 500. I think he picked up the Rio title.
Yeah, he beat Alcaraz in the final, I believe.
Yeah, he did. Clay court specialist. So when we hit the clay, maybe that's when he'll get even better results. But I thought it was a good way to go out, but a shame, because I did think at times, if he had made a few more than he missed, I did think he would probably get that one, because Zverev was a bit defensive.
He was, and I think I noticed that because of, you know, Norrie coming into the net, and again, I think that links to the aggressiveness and that change in mindset, I think, that he's had, that he was coming in to kill off the points rather than just sort of push it back in play, get embroiled in rallies and see kind of where it went. Actually, he was coming in for the kills. So I quite enjoyed seeing that. I think it's going to be fascinating to see where Cam Norrie goes from here. I mean, he didn't have the best of ends last season, and he said in his own words that he's going to take a great lot of confidence from this, from these performances. And he thinks he's got top 10 level in him. Do you see that as a realistic goal with the tennis you've seen at the Australian Open from him?
I think it's the, when I say kind of he's playing top 10 tennis, I think more than 10 people can be playing top 10 tennis. I think it's more like the level as opposed to where people currently are at.
He could be a danger player and take out a top 10.
Absolutely. I definitely think it's top 15. I think he's also got the dedication there, whereas I think there's question marks around TFO at times and some of the players in that 10 to 15 bracket who aren't necessarily kind of getting the results or putting the work in or improving their game on the regular basis. So we all know that Cam's got the work ethic, and if he is adding to his game, and he's been, you know, very high in the rankings before, I think why not? Because he has got a tricky game for many people to play against, almost sort of Manorino-esque at times. So you have to think he's going to have chances, and hopefully on Wimbledon, this new aggressive game style, you've got to think that's got to be the perfect sort of surface, especially as you say, maybe he's coming into the net more. So one to watch.
He definitely needs to keep on it with this aggressive mindset. I really, really enjoyed it. We've got to talk very quickly about the fact that there was a protest on the tennis court during this match. It was sorted like relatively like quickly, but not by the right people. It was sorted by tennis fans as opposed to security. I think it was a Palestine protester getting on the court, throwing loads of leaflets around. It was a bit farcical, to be honest. But security not really dealing with it, fans sorting it out, then coming back to, as you can imagine, a massive ovation. But yeah, very surprising that fans reacted quicker than security did.
Yeah, and we actually saw this at UTS as well, where, you know, fans kind of jumped onto the court. And I think at tennis, there is a genuine problem where I think that people need to be much more alert in these situations. I think, for example, at the US Open, there was another protest, and that was a climate change protest. And Coco Gauff said she was expecting it. So you have to think that as you go through the tournament,
I mean, that's bad. You don't want players having that in their mind that they're expecting it. I think that probably shows to me that tennis does have a problem with these sorts of things, because it does feel like they're becoming more and more frequent.
Yeah, I mean, we had the jigsaws of Wimbledon, we had climate change at the US Open, and now we've got the Free Palestine protest that's happened here. So you have to be alert to it. You hope they brief security properly on it. because you don't want to see players or fans having to step in this case, and you want very swift action to be taken. I think quite often in big stadiums it's very hard for action to be taken quickly, but there's no excuses here because it was front row, so someone should have dealt with it much quicker than they did.
And the final two players who are into the quarterfinals from day nine in the men's bottom half of the draw, Daniil Medvedev and Hubert Hurkacz. So Daniil Medvedev beat Nuno Borges in four sets. It really should have been three sets. He would have been kicking himself about that third set, but he got it job done, 6-1 in the fourth. We also had Hubert Hurkacz end the spirited run of Arthur Cazot, the French wild card, French reciprocal wild card. So we've got Medvedev, Hurkacz next. I mean, Chris, where do you stand with this one? Because Hurkacz, he is arguably maybe the best server in the game at the moment, given his numbers. And Medvedev, the defensive wall, as we all know him, and how far he likes to be at the back of the court. What do you expect from that sort of matchup?
Well, I think Medvedev's going to try and make it go long. I think that's kind of what's something that Borges said after this match. He said the way that Medvedev plays is he just grinds you down until you start missing and your level drops, and that will be key. That Hurkacz, I think, has got to get past Medvedev in three or four sets, definitely not five. I don't think that he would come out on top in that situation, and he's got to serve well, as you say. Like, he's got to serve him off the court.
It's the one thing he's got. It's the one thing he's got that's, you know,
consistently
infinitely better than what, you know, it has in Medvedev's locker. I mean, it's fascinating to see his progression on serve over the last few years, because in 2018 he held 76% of his service games, and in the past two seasons it's been up and around 90%, which ranks him, you know, in the top three in the world. So you'd expect Medvedev, he's going to have to be really on it when it comes to returning. And, you know, I expect to see more of him just standing as far back as possible so that at least he can get the ball back in play.
Yeah, and there's even a demonstration, I think, with Jim Courier was asking, like, yeah, where to stand. And I thought, is this the time? Like, maybe take this to the practice
course.
Is he just
telling Hurkacz, like, this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah, maybe it was just displaying the tactics. But, I mean, a lot of players are standing very far back, and I think you have to, mm-hmm. especially with Hurkacz, with a serve as big as his. And I always question the service position, the service return position of Medvedev, but obviously it works.
I'd be bringing out the underarm serve more.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty quick going forwards as well. I'm not sure that Hurkacz is famous for his trick shots, mm-hmm. but the question that I have around sort of Medvedev in this is that he thinks that he is very much kind of in contention here. Is he in contention based on what you've seen? Because losing a set like this from being up doesn't necessarily tell me that you're playing at the top of your game right now.
Yeah, I think that third set will be a worry, and I don't think you just can't give those opportunities you know, at this level, particularly against someone like Hubert Hurkacz, who's so strong on serve. You can't just let a player back into the game, and I would agree with you in the sense that yes, he's playing capable tennis to potentially to get to a Grand Slam final, but he can't have those lapses in concentration. And against Nuno Borges, number 69 in the world, I think he would have been disappointed himself that wasn't a straight sets job, and he had to go a bit further than he necessarily needed to.
Especially in the heat. I mean, you don't want to spend more time on court than you have to against opponents where you probably should get past them, especially given that scoreline in the third set. But Hurkacz, I think it's good that he's winning the tiebreaks, because I think that was something in the United Cup that Iga was saying, you know, that, and people said against Zverev as well, potentially, that he just wasn't getting the tiebreaks won. And you just think, how does he lose tiebreaks with the serve that he does have? And I guess it's the return game that lets him down at times. So I think as well as serving well, he's going to have to return well. And I think that's something that will be kind of very kind of decisive in the match. But I'm not expecting too many long rallies in that one.
No long rallies, lots of tie breaks. That's what I'm expecting. Before we go to a quick break, we just want to quickly touch on the mixed doubles, because Heather Watson and Joe Salisbury, they are into the quarterfinals. I believe we're going to have a British representation regardless of what happens, because I think they're playing Skupski and Krawczyk in the quarters. So, yeah, very good from the British point of view, I think, in the mixed. Is Heather Watson going to win a mixed doubles title?
Another one, you know, after winning Wimbledon. I mean, we talked about it on the last one. I think, given the quality of the opponents they've taken out as well.
Yeah.
They took out a previous champions in Matos and Stefani. And then they took out the number 8 seeds, who are very I mean, they're both very good doubles players. But I mean, Neil Skupski, that's going to be a tricky one. You feel like it's going to be very much kind of the Joe Salisbury versus Skupski, even like the Davis Cup battle.
Oh, yes.
In some
ways. I mean,
well,
I mean, Joe Salisbury and Rajiv Ram are also out of the men's doubles. So maybe there's even more motivation from Salisbury there to focus on, you know, focus now on the mixed doubles now that he's out of the men's doubles as well.
Yeah, and we should touch on the men's doubles very quickly because one of the podcast favourites, Rohan Bopanna, is up to a career-high ranking in the live rankings of number 2. And with the top seeds also going out, if they win one more round, Matthew Ebden and Bopanna, he will be the world number 1, which is the... it's incredible. At 43, it'll be the oldest world number 1 in doubles ever and the oldest first-time number 1. And that's just an unbelievable achievement. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really hope that with that sort of result that he can get a win here, especially with an Aussie partner. You think that would be so fun. But either way, I mean, defying the odds. And we thought, looking back at the start of 2023, that sort of final slam run with Mertzer, that was kind of a final hurrah. And he had very much had other ideas. It was the springboard to one of the best, well, the best season he's ever had. So... looking forward to seeing if he can get it done. And Indian number 1 in doubles would be wonderful.
India have had a cracking tournament because he obviously had the Nagal story, you know, in week 1, which was very heartwarming. And Bopanna, you know, gave the celebration to him. Maybe it's going to be the other way around now. Let's see. But yeah, good luck to Bopanna.
We're rooting for him.
We are rooting for you. But we're going to take a short break now. Do join us in the second half where we will be taking a look back on all the action from day 8 at Melbourne Park, plus looking ahead to what's in store on day 10, including the start of the quarterfinals action. So do not go anywhere.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to the Tennis Weekly podcast. And now we're going to move on to day 8, Chris. And we're going to start with Andre Rublev because the Brits are all out and the Australians are all out also in the men's draw because Alex de Minaur lost in 5 sets to Andre Rublev. De Minaur got bageled in that 5th set. It was 6-4, 6-7, 6-7, 6-3, 6-love Rublev. I want to start with that bagel because de Minaur is a player who is known for his conditioning, his fitness, and to get bageled in the 5th set, he just ran out of steam.
He really did, and it's such a shame because you just don't think that, as you say, that's not a de Minaur scoreline that we're used to at all. And I mean, it does beg the question if there was that sort of extra level that Rublev could go to. I mean, it's very positive he was able to come through in the end in that way. But I mean, he just crumbled on serve, really, which is a big shame. I mean, he just won, I think it was 25% of first serve points, and he doesn't have a big serve, so it does need to work. He does need to hit his spots, whereas it's the complete opposite with Rublev doing kind of a wonderful job and getting 86% of first serve points won. So I think Rublev does have that sort of mode he can go to where he can just see it like a and hit it. You know, he can really do that, and he did leave it all on the court. But I mean, if you are de Minaur, I mean, it's not the way you necessarily want to go out. And he didn't necessarily play too badly in that set overall. I mean, he did hit 5 winners, 3 unforced errors. But Rublev hit 9 winners, 4 unforced errors, and a lot more conversions of break points.
is that the problem with Dumanar's game? The fact that, you know, he doesn't necessarily have that weapon or that X factor, which as a result, in that fifth set, when you're knackered and you want some cheap points or some, you know, free points from a big serve or, you know, some big ground strokes, it's just not in his nature. And as a result of that, he's having to work a lot harder at times when actually he'd want some free points, which is what Rublev is able to do.
He's not a naturally aggressive player. And I think he's more of a counterpuncher, is probably how we'd describe it. So he's not getting many free points on serve. I think for the match, it was six aces, six double faults. So, you know, that's a net equal there. And it's actually, the serve is bigger than you think it is. I've just had a look at some of the numbers. It's about 209 kilometers an hour for his fastest serve of the day. Pretty good average on the second serve, though. So he does make up for a little bit of that ground there with about 10 kilometers an hour quicker on the second serve than Rublev. So that is something to go on. But, I mean, he is playing great tennis. He did upset Djokovic. It's just a shame, obviously, you can't play your best tennis all the time. And that final set was obviously, even with the crowd support, and he doesn't really play very well when he's playing for his country or in his country, it's got to be a big blow for him, because that match was highly entertaining until then.
I mean, the statistic, I now have to give you the fact that Rublev has made the quarterfinals. He is 0-9 in men's singles quarterfinals. He's got Sinner next. Is he going to break his duck finally at a Grand Slam and get to a semi-final?
I mean, it's Jannik Sinner, and he's obviously, well, he's playing phenomenal tennis, and I'd have to say it's going to be 0-10. And I think that is obviously a big shame for Rublev, because he's more than deserving of it. But I just think that in every draw, there is that someone at the quarterfinal stage, especially in the men's game, who is that bit better than him. And it's not because he doesn't have the level, but I think there are just some players, but if you bump into them in the draw, like a Djokovic, a Medvedev, or a Sinner, at this stage, they are, or an Alcaraz, they've got those four players at the top of the game who are going to make it very hard for you to get opportunities beyond the quarterfinal stage.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating.
But 0-9, is that one of the craziest records that we have in Grand Slam tennis?
It could reach double digits. And it doesn't feel right, because I think, as I say, I see Rublev, and I think at times he's played tennis that I think, you know, given the draw, given the way it could pan out, you know, luck of the draw and all that, I feel like at least once he should get his opportunity. But it just shows that it's just tough. I think when you get to quarterfinals, you just might run into someone better than you, and it's going to be hard against. It's going to be very tough against Jannik Sinner, because
is it mental? Do you think, Joel?
I think that Rublev has matured, and I think he's obviously got lots of experiences now in the bank at this level. But I do wonder if that is baggage there, and he's thinking about it, and he's just come through a quite a big five set match against Dumanur, and Jannik Sinner's just been walking through his part of the draw. I mean, he had Karen Khachanov in round four. I thought that was going to be quite a tricky challenge for him, but he got it done in straight sets, 6-4, 7-5, 6-3. So you think also Sinner is going to be fresher there. So it feels like it's all stacked and all leading towards a Sinner victory.
It really is. And I think on the Rublev, what can he do would be the question I'd say against Jannik Sinner. I think when he plays against some of these top players, I'm not sure the game plan is any different from when he plays against some of the lower ranked players. It's play front foot tennis. It's hit that forehand big. It's take on the shots. But against Sinner, I mean, it's almost like playing a version of yourself that's just probably a level better at the moment in many ways, because dangerous off both wings, similar in their build as well, similar in their stature. But someone who's just really at the top of their game, you'd have to think that Sinner's going to get it. But I mean, we shouldn't discount kind of the pedigree of Rublev. Obviously, he's won Masters titles, and if you put yourself in the quarterfinals on 9 occasions, that shows just your consistency at the top of the game in the top 8. So we've seen bigger upsets on the women's side, haven't we, Joel?
We have. I mean, before we talk about the women's draw, let's talk about the final two quarterfinalists, that we have. Novak Djokovic and Taylor Fritz. Djokovic double bageled Mannarino. There was a pity cheer when Mannarino finally won a game at the 13th game in the match, but it was 6-love, 6-love, 6-3. I mean, Djokovic not really in fifth gear, really, at the start of this tournament, but I think if there is a changing of the tide, looking back on this tournament, this was the match it happened.
It almost felt like a practice match rather than a competitive match. Mm.
I don't understand. What is it about Adrian Mannarino, I guess, that Novak Djokovic found so easy in this match, and yet every other opponent, it feels like, Mannarino just causes lots and lots of problems.
I think this was a Mannarino that was a little bit deflated from all that time spent on court. I think he tends to cause more problems to some of the younger players who find him a bit awkward to play against. Like Jack Draper, obviously, went down to him in Sofia. And then there's a few other players like Ben Shelton, another young player. It's very wily, you know, it's a very tricky game that he has, a game that he doesn't kind of give you the points and he doesn't give you the balls or the speed of the balls that you're used to. And he has a crazy string tension. So I think it kind of lends itself to being one that you have to get used to playing against more. And I think Djokovic, with all his experience, I think the tricks of Mannarino don't necessarily kind of add up to more than the tricks and experience of Novak Djokovic. And I mean, he played really well. And he said it's the best he's played in a while. And you just have to think, poor Mannarino, you know, no one wants to be playing against Djokovic when he says it's the best he's played in a while, especially when you're just coming off the back of 3-5 setters. But still,
you did wonder at times, was this going to be a triple bagel job?
And the last time, finish the match, yeah.
And the last time that happened for a player to win without dropping a game at a Grand Slam was 1993. So
who was it? Do we know?
I'm not sure who it was, but it's,
we'll have to look it up.
We've got to look it up. It's not happened at the Australian Open, but it was certainly on the cards. I mean, Djokovic has Taylor Fritz-Netz, who took out Stefanos Tsitsipas. Let's not really look at the head-to-head. I mean, I'm assuming Taylor Fritz won't want to look at the head-to-head against Djokovic because it's 8-0 in favour of Djokovic. But that was a good victory for Fritz against Tsitsipas. I think, you know, there's been a lot of hype around Ben Shelton when it comes to American men's tennis, and arguably maybe also like Francis Tiafoe. You know, we had that great run from Christopher Eubanks as well at Wimbledon last year. Not really spoken about Taylor Fritz that much, but this was a very good win for him. And I'll say, to me, sort of announced himself back up at the top of the tree of the US men's game.
Yeah, and you did call this. You're a big believer in Fritz's game, Joel. And I think it was quite nice because you feel like he's someone who does apply himself, who does have the game, but he doesn't always get the result. I think at the US Open, he had a very, very easy path to the quarterfinal. It was almost a non-event. And then obviously going down very easily in that quarterfinal. Yeah. So it's going to be a different way for him to go into the match. I think he will have more hopes and expectations than he has done previously. He did play well, but I think it's a big step up. And having never done it before, Djokovic coming off the back of playing some of his best tennis, I think it's probably the wrong round to meet Novak Djokovic at a slam, if there ever is a right one.
Yeah, it's tough. It's very tough to see, you know, it not going Novak Djokovic's way. I mean, one thing we need to talk about is the Vegemite debacle with Taylor Fritz's girlfriend.
Morgan.
She said, or she challenged to Fritz, that if Fritz won, she would have some Vegemite. And
the whole jar, apparently.
We didn't get the whole jar, though, did we?
We didn't. She had one spoonful and did not like it. But I would say, on the subject of that, I love Vegemite. I actually prefer it to Marmite. I really do. So I'm not sure where you stand on this, Joel, but I would happily, you know, eat the whole pot of Vegemite.
Do we, on our next tour catch-up, do we need to have some Vegemite between us and do a little taste session
that
between
is possible.
Ourselves?
I can pop over to Mama. There's a British supermarket there that has Vegemite, of all things, which seems more of an Australian supermarket. But
I somehow don't think Vegemite are going to be signing up Morgan as a brand ambassador anytime soon.
No, but maybe they can kind of convince her as a skeptic to embrace it. That potentially could be a nice move from them. But Tennis Weekly is much better at sipping a Pimm's and doing a taste test that way than we are going for the Vegemite or the yeast-based spreads.
I mean, let's move on to the women's draw in the bottom half, because talking about the bottom half, it feels like a complete world away from that top half, because we've got Krejčíková, we've got Sabalenka, we've got Coco Gauff. There feels like there's threats everywhere. And one of the reasons for that is Krejčíková came through Mira Andreeva in a really tough battle, 4-6, 6-3, 6-2. This was very impressive. I feel like this is the Krejčíková of old. You know, we've not really seen much of her at this stage of a Grand Slam singles draw. And, you know, there may be, you know, bad blood. We're not sure between Krejčíková and Siniaková with that split, you know, in the doubles. But maybe it's having its desired effect. I don't know. I know she still likes to play all the tournaments available in Grand Slam. She's still in the ladies doubles. But she's still,
and the mix. Is she in the mix as well?
Yeah, and the mix maybe. As well, yeah. But she seems to be bringing it in the singles, which, as I say, we've not really been at this talking point with her for a while.
I can confirm she did actually pull out of her, thank goodness she pulled out of her mixed first round yesterday. So that was definitely a good move. But I mean, it's a bit of a shame for Andreeva in this sense, because there was so much talk about it. And it's almost like when she went up against someone who you thought, right, maybe she's the favorite for this one, then it does become very difficult. And that's going to be something that some of the girls in the top half of the draw are going to have to contend with, not having that sort of free hitting of not being the favorite. Yeah. So I think it was a shame for her in that sense. But I mean, Krejčíková in that first set, it was really ugly. It was not good. I think it's impressive that she found a way. And I think that's her, as we've talked about before, the experience on the tour. But in that first set, it was four winners and 21 unforced errors from Krejčíková. So it was pretty much as bad as it gets. And balls were firing over the baseline. Of all sorts. Then she really did level the ship in the second with 14 winners to 15 unforced errors, whereas Andreeva did kind of let loose a little bit more, and she did miss more. And then it was pretty good from the final set with 14 winners to 3 unforced errors. So she got better and better as the match went on. But against, you know, in the next round against Sabalenka, you can't afford to start slowly. You've really got to get going quickly, and especially a player who's caused her a lot of trouble in the past. But again, good to see her at this stage, and we've seen her play some amazing tennis in the past, and having someone else who's playing at the top of the game is always beneficial, because she was talking about whether she should be in the big three, you know, less than a year ago, and then she dropped off the map.
I'm slowly starting to see that argument, but against Sabalenka, her head-to-head, I mean, she's lost four out of her five previous encounters with her. I mean, all I will say about Sabalenka is that she is just strolling through this draw. She beat Anna Samova, who I thought was playing pretty good tennis in Melbourne, 6-3, 6-2. Is there an argument to say that Sabalenka hasn't had that test yet, and that could make her go unstuck, you know, later in the tournament? Do you see that argument, or do you think actually she would just rather have these very easy victories and not be tested until these later rounds?
I think with her, so much of it, I mean, it is mental. In the final against Coco Gauff, she did completely go off the boil mentally, and she really should have probably got that wrapped up. But Coco was rock solid when it came to those big moments. And you have to think that she's done this before, where she's played impeccable tennis until it gets really tight. And then that's where you see like which Sabalenka is going to be there that day, because she did play brilliantly in Australian Open final last year. But again, I mean, it was pretty close, and a couple of double faults serving for it here and there could have led to a different result. But maybe I'm thinking that having kind of got to number one and then having that taken away, maybe that's really put the fire in her, because she hasn't won a slam in the last year. And she is someone who you would expect to have pushed on more than that than she has. So it's weighing up the expectation versus kind of, is it the fire in the belly? And for me, I think it looks like she's really fired up for this one. And I think she loves playing in Australia. So I'm not sure she needs a test. I think actually, ideally not having a test is the best way for her to come through the tournament.
Well, another player who's not really been tested either is Coco Gauff, who came through Magdalena Frecz of Poland, 6-1, 6-2. She has Marta Kostyuk next, who defeated Timofeeva 6-2, 6-1 to reach the second week of a slam for the first time. I say, Coco Gauff, very similar story. She had a great, you know, US Open, winning her first ever Grand Slam as well. Are we just destined for Gauff Sabalenka in the semis, or do you see Kostyuk posing any sort of problems to Coco?
She's a fantastic mover, and some of the gets I've seen from her have been really, really impressive. Coco is a better, again, and we talked about this before, it's almost a better version of Kostyuk in many ways because they're fantastic movers, but Coco has really brought her game on an awful lot. And I don't think she's like a Yastremska where she can take her game, you know, to a fantastic level that's almost unplayable. And I think Yastremska can hit you off the court. That's not how Kostyuk plays her matches. And Coco's defense will make it very hard for someone to get past her and get the ball past her, especially with these sort of very heavy balls that they're playing with down under. So I don't think it's going to be a great matchup for Kostyuk, but I think, will there be chances? There might be, but I think that we are destined for a Goff. I mean, I don't think Krejcikova is going to take out Sabalenka, and I don't think that Kostyuk is going to take out Goff. So I'd say yes then, Joel.
Yeah, it's very exciting. And it's interesting. I say, when with Sabalenka, you don't get a lot of players defend trophies or titles on the WTA Tour. And Sabalenka's got this golden opportunity, I think, to do that, you know, at a Grand Slam level. But similarly, Coco Goff, she's picking up where she left off, you know, at the US Open last year. So it's fascinating to see how that develops on, you know, in the bottom half of the ladies' draw. I mean, looking forward to day 10, tennis tomorrow. We've got Marta Kostyuk, Coco Gauff, Djokovic, Fritz, Krejcikova, Sabalenka, Sinner, Rublev. I'm going to ask Chris for your predictions in name and number of sets, please. And we've got some doubles. We've got some doubles as well. As I say, the marquee doubles match is Watson, Salisbury, Krawczyk, Skupski. But yes,
well, I'll start with the doubles then. I've got to start with the doubles.
Okay, just for, right. The token Watson, Salisbury, Krawczyk, Skupski prediction.
I think it's two sets. Watson, Salisbury.
Ooh. Okay. Okay. Right. Now on to the singles. What are we going with? Kostyuk, Goff.
Goff in two.
Djokovic, Fritz.
I think Djokovic in three.
Krejcikova, Sabalenka.
I think there might be something wild going on in this. I hope this is like WTA tings on the at the Australian Open. So I might say Sabalenka in three with a really rogue set thrown in.
Sinner, Rublev.
I would love this to go to more than three sets, but I do just think Sinner is playing so well, and against Khachanov he had the perfect preparation for this one, so I'm going to say Sinner in three.
I'm going to go Sinner in five. I agree with you on all the other results except that. I'm going to go Sinner in five. Okay. I think Rublev is still going to happen, but I think he's going to put up a fight more than straight sets. Yeah, we'll see. Interestingly, Novak Djokovic is on the day session on Rod Laver Arena. That doesn't happen very often. I can't tell you the last time it happened, but I was reading it earlier. It was a long, long time ago.
And I've seen some rumblings that this is in preparation because the semi-final will be the day session against Sinner. Okay. So people are saying maybe this is scheduling request from Djokovic to maybe play in the heat of the day. Ooh. So that he's ready for it. But
it
could
well be.
He hasn't had to for years, so maybe he just thought, I want to warm up a little bit.
Exactly. Well, yeah, it'd be interesting to see. I mean, I don't feel like that's going to have a big factor, but who knows? But yeah, we've got some very exciting matches in the quarterfinals to come tomorrow. Before we wrap up this episode, Chris, we are going to be talking about Collector Set.
We don't have to, Joel. We honestly don't have to. It's fine.
Alluded to it at the beginning because it has been a very, very eventful Collector Set. We had our six players, Grigor Dimitrov, Jack Draper, Alex de Minaur, Naomi Osaka, Emma Raducanu, Elina Svitolina. All those players are now out, so we can already give the collector set result and announce our winner.
Unheard of. Has this ever happened before?
I know. I can't remember. Like, on all the editions we've done of collector set, I feel like this is one of the quickest we have ever had. And it
no
is
calculators
also,
either. Yeah.
No calculators either. And it is also one of the highest scoring ever collector sets. We were very, very close to actually having for the first time 6 out of 6 player pick predictions correct. But sadly, that was not the case. However, we did have a outright winner. So, drum roll, please. Oh.
Ooh, come on, here we go.
With 5 correct answers, it is Lin Pin. Lin Pin, well done. You are our collector set AO champion. And this has thrown up a bit of a quandary, because we believe that Lin Pin, you've won collector set before, so we cannot give you another mug.
No, so we have a wonderful option for you. We have Tennis Weekly merch now. Thank goodness we got this made, because otherwise you'd have to have another mug. So we'll be contacting you.
You'd have to deal with a second mug.
Exactly. We'll be contacting you about which one of our lovely pieces of merch you would like. We have a lovely cap. We have a lovely two designs of tote bags. So we will be messaging you, but congratulations on that win. Five is a phenomenal effort, especially because it's quite bold to say that none of these players would make it, you know, to the quarterfinals or further, because we thought some of these would be the form players. So very, very impressive. And there are some other people who also did very well, didn't they, Joel? Did you do well?
I did, and one of them was me, surprisingly. Yes. There were a handful of players with four correct answers. So special shout out to these players who got involved. David Blair, Irene Gango, The Tennis Porker, Liv, Laura Kneebone, and Ian Ray, as well as myself, all getting four correct answers. But Lin Pin takes it outright with five.
And how did Kim do out of Kim and I?
That is a very good point, because we do need to settle now the slam spoon of shame. And we actually already have a definitive winner as well for that. And it is...
Oh.
It's you, Chris. Chris.
Oh, Joel, I've had it for...
One correct answer.
I've had it for
Kim
a year.
Kim got two, you got one. So,
and I got that on the first round, didn't I? Osaka, that was it.
Yes. So
I'm an optimist. Is that a crime?
You can keep the spoon for now. The slam spoon of shame is staying with you.
A whole year with the spoon of shame. It's particularly painful, because that's actually my sister, Laura
Kneebone.
Does it actually exist?
Yeah, I still haven't actually seen it in person. I want to see it.
I've not seen it in person, but they're decorated beautifully. We've got faces on them and everything. but I think Kim physically has them, but in terms of who has them right now, it's been me for a while.
Yes. Well, yes, you can keep it now until the French Open. I'm slightly relieved, because I was a little bit nervous. But
unless Sinner wins, though, maybe we'll get rid of it if Sinner wins.
Oh, okay, we'll see.
I'll make my case later in the tournament.
Yeah, okay. We'll wait till the end of the week. But listeners, we're going to end our round four catch up here. I hope you've enjoyed our latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all the action still to come from the Australian Open. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
You can also follow us on social media or email the show. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube. And the handle for them is Tennis Weekly Pod. You can purchase Tennis Weekly merch at etsy.com/shop/Tennis Weekly Podcast. You can email the show tennisweeklypod@gmail.com or check out our website tennisweekly.co.uk.
And we will be back on Wednesday at Tennis Weekly HQ for our quarterfinals AO catch-up. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Chris.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you again soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.